Thank you to all of you. I just want to say here at the beginning, as an alum and as a faculty member, and on behalf of all of the faculty here, thank you so much to the foundation staff, the foundation board, the alumni council, all of you who are here today. We care deeply about the welfare of this institution, and we are extremely lucky and extremely grateful that you give so much of yourselves every year to this institution. So thank you very much. Thank you on behalf of all of us. Now, I saw one of you yesterday, and you asked very kindly for a preview of today's talk, and I had to say, I've got to be honest with you, you don't want to hear this thing twice. I've been aiming to make it listenable one time, right? You really don't want to hear it two times. So, and if it turns out not to be listenable the one time, just remind yourselves, at least I don't have to hear it twice. So I'm going to start, we're going to talk today about free speech in the 21st century, and here's the part of the First Amendment that matters to us for these purposes. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. And I'm first going to ask you a question, which you can just answer to yourselves in your head. What is it that first comes to mind for you when I say the First Amendment or the freedom of speech? So for some of you, it might be an adjective like important or controversial or annoying, or it might be a case like New York Times versus Sullivan, a really big case, changed defamation law forever. It's 50 years old this year. Maybe it's a famous phrase, something like the marketplace of ideas, or Holmes's phrase, shouting fire in a crowded theater, something that the First Amendment apparently does not allow you to do, so don't make that mistake. Or maybe it's a controversial message that's been covered by the First Amendment, something like the Nazis marching in Skokie, or flag burning, or draft card burning, or cross burning. There's a lot of burning in the First Amendment. We could have a whole unit just on burning in the First Amendment class. So whatever you think of, I'm going to ask you to think about that in relation to the examples that I'm going to give you today. I'm going to give you examples of real cases of what's going on in the First Amendment today in the 21st century. So here's some examples of what free speech looks like. Verizon. You guys have probably heard of net neutrality, right? A very controversial attempt to regulate how internet service providers provide content, deliver content to users like us using the internet. Verizon challenged net neutrality rules on many grounds, one of which, though, was a First Amendment claim that the First Amendment makes them immune to net neutrality regulations. Google runs a search engine. We all know Google so well, it's a verb, right? You Google it. Google has defended its search algorithm on the basis that the First Amendment gives it protection to run its search however it wants to. And essentially, Verizon and Google are making basically the same claim. And their claim is, we are like newspaper editors. Verizon as an internet service provider, or Google as a search engine, they say, we make decisions about what content comes first, what content comes later. And for the government to tell us how to do that would be a form of interference with our editorial discretion. It would be like telling a newspaper editor what articles you have to put in the newspaper or in what order you have to present them. We don't do that to newspaper editors. You can't do it to us. I have a third example, which sounds a little different at the beginning, but I think is actually quite similar. It involves a Los Angeles County ordinance that was passed last year called Measure B. And Measure B requires people who are working in the pornography industry to wear condoms on the job. And a pornography industry trade group challenged this on First Amendment grounds, saying that it interfered with the ability of their workers to express themselves, as it were. And also that the condom requirement, I kid you not, constituted an unconstitutional prior restraint. Pun not intended. This is a family program. We'll keep it clean. So similarly, we've got this claim. The First Amendment tells us that you can't get involved in how we do our business. You can't interfere with what we're doing. So internet search providers Internet service providers, search engines, pornography industry, these all, according to them, are First Amendment issues, right? They're protected by the First Amendment. And actually, incidentally, these have not been home run claims, but they've met with a surprising amount of success. So Verizon, they won their net neutrality challenge on other grounds. And the court said, we're not getting to the First Amendment challenge. But nor did the DC Circuit say, we reject this outright, right? They left the question open, and a lot of people have read the opinion to suggest that actually in the way they were treating Verizon, the DC Circuit thinks that Verizon is a speaker for First Amendment purposes. Google hasn't had a chance to use its claim in litigation, but a Chinese search engine used it in the Southern District of New York and won on it to say that they were protected by the First Amendment. The way their algorithm works is First Amendment protected. And actually, the pornography industry, the judge, the federal district court judge in that case said, probably health considerations ultimately justify Measure B, but they completely agreed with the plaintiffs that this was a First Amendment issue and actually totally bought their prior restraint argument, which I'm happy to talk about more if you want, but I won't do that right now. So all of these people have raised First Amendment claims to some degree of success. Now, here's another set of recent plaintiffs who've met with even more success. These have been claims that either have won or look like they're going to win. Conflict Minerals. Last month, the DC Circuit ruled that the SEC violated the First Amendment when it told companies that they had to disclose whether their products include conflict minerals. Now, actually, diamonds aren't included in this. It's gold and tin and some other minerals, but who doesn't like looking at a diamond? So I put a diamond up there. But, you know, in order, the rule said you have to say if this is conflict-free or not conflict-free, and the companies challenged it and won. They don't have to do that. The First Amendment says they don't have to do that. Tattoo parlors. That's a picture of someone getting a tattoo. That's about as close as I want to get to that particular process, and don't Google tattoos, by the way. I don't recommend doing that. But the Supreme Court of Arizona applied the First Amendment to a city council's decision to deny a use permit to a tattoo parlor. So this is straight up local government zoning decisions. Tattoo parlors and other types of various types of businesses have to get a use permit to locate in a particular place. And the Supreme Court of Arizona said the decision to deny the tattoo parlor a use permit triggered the First Amendment and was subject to review under First Amendment intermediate scrutiny. Beef. It's what's for dinner. There's a whole other First Amendment case about exactly that slogan, which we won't even get into. This is a different case about beef. This is a DC Circuit case. The DC Circuit this month is going en banc to figure out whether beef producers can be required to put on the labels of their products the country of origin of the beef. The beef producers say the First Amendment keeps us from having to disclose the country of origin of the meat. And a panel of the DC Circuit disagreed with that, but now they're going en banc, which suggests at least some of them think that this is a very difficult question. So we're gonna see what happens with that. So conflict minerals, tattoos, meat, also First Amendment issues. So one point here is that this is not your grandfather's First Amendment. This is not the First Amendment of the First Amendment's grandfathers. This is Holmes and Brandeis. We can think of them as kind of the grandfathers of the modern First Amendment. They're the people who first said in the late 19-teens, early 1920s, hey, maybe there's some work for the First Amendment to do when we are prosecuting people for obstructing World War I when all they've done is circulate a socialist pamphlet. Now, maybe some of those people should go to jail, but the First Amendment says to us we should think twice before we do that, and there are some hard questions we might need to ask about exactly what it is that those speakers did before we send them to jail. This First Amendment I'm talking about, the First Amendment of beef and tattoos, would be unrecognizable to Holmes and Brandeis. Now, there's a lot we could ask about that. We could ask, why is this happening? We could ask, how do we feel about it? We could ask, based on how we feel about it, what, if anything, should change about it? I'm not going to try to answer those questions here. I want to make three observations about this phenomenon that maybe will help us think about it and that will put us on a road where we could maybe answer some of these other questions. So the first observation is, although Holmes and Brandeis would not have thought of the tattoo parlor's claim as a First Amendment claim, and that would not have been something they recognized, they might have thought that type of claim belonged on another part of their docket, and it might have been familiar to them from another part of their docket. To think about why, let's think about the interests that the tattoo parlors or the pornography workers or Google or Verizon, let's think about the interests that they're raising here. What is it that they want? Well, basically, they want to be able to run their business the way they want without the interference of the government. They want to be able to decide where they locate, how they go about their work, which content they put in which place, without the government claiming you have to do it our way. They want to do it their way. Okay, that's what the tattoo parlor people want. They want to be able to locate where they want to locate. So let's think about another plaintiff. Let's say instead of a tattoo parlor, he runs a bakery. And he'd like to be able to run his bakery his way. He does not want the government telling him things like maybe where to locate, or maybe how many people he can hire, or maybe how many hours those people can work. That is a claim that has been made in front of the Supreme Court. That was a claim made by a baker named Joseph Lochner. The case was Lochner versus New York. It was in 1905. And I would guarantee that most, if not all of you, read it in law school. And I would bet that you read it for the proposition that this is a type of constitutional review that we don't do anymore. This was Lochner-era economic due process, where the court looks at a regulation and says, we're going to ask whether this infringes on someone's economic liberty or not. And later the court said, you know what, economic regulation gets rational basis review, which is to say a very light, very deferential form of review. It's going to be very permissive to whatever the government's interests are. The First Amendment, of course, gives much higher protection than that. So the question here is, a baker making these kinds of claims today is going to lose. Joseph Lochner would lose his claims today. The tattoo parlor is winning. What is the difference between the bakery and the tattoo parlor? Is the fact that one of these makes skin pictures and the other makes bread a reason enough to give them such wildly different levels of constitutional protection? So the big question here, and the first question to ask is, what counts as economic regulation and what counts as speech protection, speech regulation? Given that we treat these things very, very differently, we're going to have to put a particular regulation on one side of the line or the other, and figuring that out seems to have gotten harder and harder to do. I want to note that anyone who works in this field is standing on the shoulders of giants. The people who recognize this problem earliest and put it most compellingly were Tom Jackson and John Jeffries, future deans of this law school. A nice picture. I asked John for permission to borrow his image and ideas before using them here today. So Tom Jackson and John Jeffries wrote an article when the Supreme Court started protecting commercial speech. They said, this looks familiar. This looks like the type of protection that the courts were giving to economic interests, economic liberty in the Lochner era. They said economic due process is resurrected in this commercial speech doctrine. It's resurrected, clothed in the ill-fitting garb of the First Amendment, and sent forth to battle the kind of special interest legislation that the court has tolerated for more than 40 years. In short, the Supreme Court has reconstituted the values of Lochner versus New York as components of freedom of speech. Well, it's turned out to be a much bigger problem than just advertising, just commercial speech and just commercial speech regulation. And you know, some of these examples like the tattoo parlor and the meat and all of these and the search engine suggest it's become a very, very big problem indeed. So the second point I want to make is that the First Amendment, just generally speaking, in these examples and in many others, are what John has called an imperialist doctrine. It conquers territory. It rolls through town, trampling and pillaging everything it sees. And once it's moved into a particular territory, it tends not to roll back. It doesn't ever give it up. This becomes permanently occupied territory. So over the years, a number of activities that were never thought to raise First Amendment issues in the first place now have become under the First Amendment umbrella. And we could talk about our examples today. We can talk about the meat and the tattoos. We can talk about violent video games. We can talk about videos of animals being tortured. We can talk about prescriber data information, all sorts of things we could talk about that are examples of this. And it's not always clear that the First Amendment is where these things belong or the right tool for the job. And some of the best things that have been written on this have been written by one of, well, the foremost First Amendment scholar in the country, our very own Fred Schauer, whose image I also got permission to borrow here today. Fred, I think, is in Switzerland. He's a sought-after person. But Fred is the foremost First Amendment scholar in the country, and he's given us a metaphor to think about this, which is, what if you wanted to hammer a nail into a board and you don't have a hammer, but you have a pipe wrench? If you really want that nail in that board, chances are most of us are going to start banging away with the pipe wrench. And that may not be the best thing, but it may get the job done. The First Amendment is like the law's pipe wrench. Like the pipe wrench, the First Amendment is frequently called on to do a job for which it is poorly designed. The job frequently gets done, but as with driving a nail with a pipe wrench, the job gets done poorly and the tool is damaged in the process. So the First Amendment keeps expanding. It's kind of like this pipe wrench. It turns out there are a lot of nails out there, and we've got this pipe wrench, and instead of picking up something else, we just go along the line banging the nails. The third observation I want to make about this is, not only is this a big doctrine, and not only is it a doctrine that creates these problems of economic versus speech regulation, the third thing is, this is a very hard problem to deal with. And there are a lot of different ways in which that's true, but the one I want to talk about here is kind of phenomenological. There are a lot of things that involve speech. So I think that what we have here is basically kind of a catch-up problem. You've all heard the story back in the day along the way somewhere. Someone decided that ketchup was a vegetable. And you can see the logic of that, because if what you need are vegetables on the plate in the school cafeteria, suddenly you look at ketchup again and you say, you know what? It's got tomatoes in it. Tomato's a vegetable. Ketchup's a vegetable. Well, what a lot of people want is help with challenging regulations. And the First Amendment is a very powerful tool for doing that. And not only is it a very powerful tool, but there's a lot of speech and a lot of different things. So there are a lot of things you can look at the way that you would look at ketchup and say, you know what? It's got some speech in it. You know, it's got some information, it's got some communication, it's got some sort of speech. I mean, we're doing it now, we're talking. And in an information society of the type that we live in, that phenomenon's only going to grow. There are more and more things about which we could say, I think it's got some speech in it. And if something has speech in it, if it's under the First Amendment, it might get quite a lot of protection. So there's this incentive to look at something and say, you know what? This suddenly looks like a First Amendment problem. It seems very hard to pull that back. And it seems difficult partly because that outward expansion impetus is going to be so strong. There's so many things with speech in them. And to counter it, you're going to need something that's a very finely grained tool that separates out, that distinguishes between all the different ways that we use speech in everyday life. It's going to have to be a theory that is nuanced and delicate and hard to make and probably boring. And it's going to be hard for it to work successfully and comprehensively, and that's going to be even harder for it to grab the attention of either the courts or the public, especially as against this sort of totemic idea of, well, it's got speech in it, therefore First Amendment. So my message to you is this. The nature of the First Amendment is to expand. Like the universe, it is expanding. It has expanded in a way that makes it difficult to sort out what counts as speech regulation and what counts as economic regulation. As long as we're treating those two things differently, we're going to have to draw lines. And practically speaking, we're going to have to draw lines anyway. It can't be that the entire universe is made of speech. There has to be a line somewhere. But these lines are very difficult to draw, and they're working in kind of an uphill battle. against this totemic idea that speech is special and there are lots of things that have speech in them. So I can't offer any help today in figuring out where that line is. What is the First Amendment? Tattoo parlor. What isn't? Baker. But I think figuring out that line is the central question in free speech in the 21st century. And although I haven't offered answers today, what I can say is that on this faculty, we have not only John Jeffries and Fred Schauer, who I've mentioned, but also Rich Schrager and Micah Schwartzman and Doug Laycock and Richard Bonney and Brandon Garrett and Mike Gilbert and Dan Ortiz, all of whose research in one way or another touches on this question. So quite frankly, there's not a better place in the country to be working on it. I am very glad to be here to talk to you about free speech in the 21st century and to be able to work on it with my colleagues here. So thank you very much.